Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name's Amy Lansky, and I'm pre-recording this show this month because I'm actually going to be having an interview. And today was the only day I could do the interview. So this will not be a live show. Now, I just thought I'd go over a few current events in homeopathy. I'm going to try to include that in the show each month. And I thought a good thing to talk about this month would be the flu, since it's in the news all the time and we're hearing about it, the scares about the avian flu. I just want to let you know that homeopathy has an unbelievable track record in treating the flu. In fact, the flu epidemic we all hear about, the 1918 flu epidemic that killed so many people all over the world, homeopathy had amazing success in this flu. In fact, in the United States, the fatality rate among homeopaths was just over 1%, whereas among conventional doctors, the fatality rate averaged about 30%. So homeopathy was very successful in this epidemic, and in fact was used widely because homeopathy was still very much a popular medicine at that time. In fact, there were whole hospitals in New York City that only treated their patients homeopathically and had amazing successes. Now, there's many approaches to treating the flu with homeopathy, and you probably have heard about some of them if you follow homeopathy at all. One approach is to take the remedy influenzinum, which is actually made from a previous flu, as a prophylactic remedy. I myself don't do this, although if I was going to be traveling in an area where I know that the flu might be more prevalent, I might consider it as a tactic. Another approach is to, at the first sign of a flu, is take some remedies that this particular remedy that has actually been proven in at least two scientific studies to diminish or halt the flu in its tracks, and it's called acylococcinum. And you can find it in the health food stores. It's made by Boiron, and it's actually made from the liver of a duck, which is interesting since this is a bird, and we're talking about avian flu here. And birds are usually the transmitters of these dangerous flus. Probably the best approach, though, and the approach that helped people in the 1918 flu epidemic, is to find what we call the genus epidemicus of the particular flu epidemic. And what that means is once people are starting to come down with the flu, homeopaths assemble the symptoms that they find in many of the cases and essentially treat the flu as a single case of disease. So let's say they've had 10 patients, they notice that they all tend to have these kinds of symptoms, mental and physical, and find the right remedy for that case, or at least two or three remedies that seem to be working. And those remedies are called the genus epidemicus, the remedies for the epidemic. Those remedies can be used not just to treat people who've gotten the flu, but also as a prophylactic against the flu. And there's many, many instances of this being successful for a variety of epidemics over the past 200 years, including cholera, typhoid, scarlet fever, flu, even smallpox. So this is the best approach. And in fact, the National Center for Homeopathy has a facility on their website that they've been developing called the Flu Tracker, where homeopaths can go in and say which remedies they've been using, what the symptoms have been like for the flu, so that they can figure out what the genus epidemicus for the flu is going to be. That said, too, there's usually about 10 different remedies that are very commonly used in the flu, and the National Center also has articles that describe those remedies, what their particular flu characteristics are. So I really recommend, if you're interested in this topic, interested in avoiding the flu vaccine for you and for your children, which, by the way, does have thimerosal in it, that you go to the National Center for Homeopathy website, which is www.homeopathic.org, which is HOMEOPATHIC.org. And on the main page there, there's a box of projects, and then within that box you'll see the flu tracker, and go in there, poke around. There's lots of historical articles. There's articles about common flu remedies, etc. Another excellent resource is a book by Sandra Perko, P-E-R-K-O, about homeopathic treatment of the flu, which goes into the historical record of the successes of homeopathy, and also gives lots of tips about common flu remedies. So that's an excellent book, and I believe she's now coming out with a new book, I'm not sure if it's a new edition of her book, that deals specifically with the avian flu. So that's another really great resource. Okay, well, also for first-time listeners who've never listened to this show before, I want to encourage you to try and listen to past archives of this show. Although each show is more or less self-contained, in general, I'm structuring the show as a sort of an introductory course on homeopathy based on my book, which is called Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy. This book, which I really encourage you to buy because you'll really benefit more from this show and will also really understand homeopathy better, this book is now pretty much the premier patient education book in our country, and now it's available in German translation too. It will really give you a good idea of what homeopathy is all about and what it's capable of. And in addition to providing a comprehensive introduction to homeopathy, what really makes it interesting is that it also includes dozens of stories of homeopathic cures for a wide variety of ailments, not just autism. It includes a full chapter on how my son Max was cured of autism, but it also has cures for a wide variety of other physical, mental, emotional problems, dozens, really, of first-person stories. So you can find out more about ordering Impossible Cure on the book website, which is impossiblecure.com. Basically, if you're just interested in buying a single book, I encourage people to order it on Amazon, or I also list there the numbers of homeopathic booksellers that you can buy it from. Now, if you're interested in listening to past archives of the show, which is a great thing to do, you can first look through the Autism One radio archives, but I think they only go back so far. For the earliest shows which aren't in the archives, you can find them on the ImpossibleCure.com website. And I want to particularly encourage you, if you have an autistic child, to listen to the February and March 2005 shows. The February show describes my son's curative experiences with homeopathy, so I know that'll be of particular interest to you parents. And the March show is really important, too, because it provides an introductory lecture on homeopathic philosophy. In other words, how homeopaths view why disease occurs, how it happens, and how cure can really be achieved without dangerous suppression. Suppressing the symptoms, but curing them instead of suppressing them. So also, while you're at the ImpossibleCure.com website, you'll find a bunch of other things of interest to you. First of all, there's a page on autism treatment with referral lists for recommended homeopaths. And you'll also find the Cure Stories database with stories contributed by others, and I really encourage you to contribute your own stories, no matter how small. Your stories that you contribute will really help others encourage others to try homeopathy. And there's also lots of other info, various links, etc. Anyway, it's time to move on to today's show. I'm really excited because we have a guest on the show today, Nancy Frederick. Nancy is a certified classical homeopath who's practicing in Maine. And I first heard about her when one of her patients, the family of an autistic child, contacted me to tell me about their amazing experiences with homeopathy. And they were actually asking some advice of me, and I actually do email exchange with many parents who are asking me for advice and referrals. And in fact, this particular mother, in the very first show, the January show, I read one of her testimonial about her son's cure as part of that show. And really, in many ways, her testimony is even more amazing than my son Max's cure story, because her son was much more deeply impacted by the autism, was much more limited, and made a remarkable recovery over the course of about 1 or 2 years. Now, since that time, once I got to know about Nancy through this patient, I have referred many patients to her, and I know that her practice has really grown to include many more autistic children, and that she's having a lot of success with them. So Nancy's become one of my favorite referrals in the Northeast area. Her practice is now in Maine. So without further ado, we'll begin our talk with Nancy. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi, Amy.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Oh, good. So it's nice to talk to you again. So, you know, we got our listeners here, and they're interested in hearing about your practice, about homeopathy. Most of them are parents of autistic kids who listen in on this show. So why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about how you became interested in homeopathy and about yourself.
Okay. Well, it was literally by accident. One of my sons fell trying to do a trick on top of a basketball hoop and fractured both of his arms quite severely. And a friend brought over a homeopathic kit and a book and said, I know there's arnica in here and other remedies too that will help him heal. And his progress was miraculous, and I realized I needed to find out more about homeopathy and how it worked. And so I enrolled in the closest school I could find, which was the New England School of Homeopathy, Paul Hersky School, in Springfield, Mass. At the time, in Northampton, Mass. And it was a wonderful experience for 3 years. And then I studied with Rajan Sankaran, and Lou Klein came to the East Coast, and his school ran for 3 years in Boston. And that was probably the biggest influence on my practice. So it's probably been about 16 years now I've been practicing and loving every minute of it. I never stop learning.
I know. Homeopathy is something you just have to keep doing all the time,
uh-huh.
It seems. So why don't you describe your practice a bit, like what patient base you see, how many autistic patients you have in your practice.
Okay. I would guess I probably have about 75 to 80 kids, some of whom I no longer see. Some are well and don't come back, and others just have moved on to other things because, as we know, we don't help everyone all the time. But I've learned a lot from each one of them. I have two offices in Maine, and then I also practice a bit in Connecticut. Husband and I lived there for a while, and I opened an office, and I see quite a few kids from the New York, New Jersey area, and I continue to go down there to see new patients and follow up with them. It's a good central location. And what's really neat about that is because it's basically autistic kids and their families, we engineer the environment so it's more for full observation. They have a lot of space to kind of do what they do. And brothers and sisters come along, and it's really kind of a low-key environment, not so much like the office. And that works. I find that works.
So you have 75 to 80 of your patients are autistic kids then?
Yeah.
So is that most? And what do you have, other adults or other children too?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a regular practice, but it just seems like I've seen quite a few of these kids in the last 4 or 5 years.
That's because I keep referring them
to.
So what percentage of your practice would you say are autistic kids?
Oh, my gosh. 30?
Yeah, so that's a lot.
20.
Yeah.
And anyway. And then there are people that sometimes you wonder, they're somewhere on the spectrum, but not with Asperger's or some other PDD, some other disorder that kind of removes them from the mainstream a little bit.
Right.
And I seem to have much better results with them than with autistic kids, even though autistic kids tend to do well with homeopathy. But it's just, it's finding that remedy.
It's hard.
Yeah.
And
parents, I think, are key. If parents can, most of them have done a lot of other therapies and continue to do them. And the trick is finding the individuality of the child despite the compensations that some of these therapies cause in these kids. So,
well, we're going to get a lot into that about what you think helps and, you know, just the whole features of the treatment
sure.
for these kids. So you mentioned that, you know, you have a sort of a open family-like atmosphere when you're doing the intake. So what can people expect in their first appointment when they come to see you? How can they prepare for that appointment?
Well, I usually take a family history. I don't have a family history form. I find that it works better for me to just have a conversation with the parents. And it's a matter of I get to know them in that way, in how they think about where they came from, how they see their child as part of the family unit. And that's really important to me, is just the tone of things. And parents oftentimes will say, well, I have to bring the baby. And I think, well, that's fine, because I want to see what kind of interaction there is between the other family members and this child. And I don't, when there seems to be issues with parents, I don't have any qualms at all about saying, you know, it might help if you wanted to get your case taken, because it will help me understand your child even more. And one of the things I've noticed, Amy, is that when you're doing a history, parents will often say, oh, you know, my parents are healthy, I've been healthy all my life, and the things that we've grown accustomed to suffering from in our culture really are things that that are unhealthy, but we just assume that hypertension and coronary bypass, and because they're so common, that we don't see them as pathology and things that can lead to, you know, miasmatic weakness and so forth.
Right, right. So what kind of things are you looking for in that first appointment, or any appointment, really?
I'm looking for the general health of the family and where this child came from. Because there's so much emphasis now on vaccine damage, and we're seeing children who are third and fourth generation, sometimes even fifth generation, immunized population, I want to be clear about what the susceptibilities are in previous generations. So
do you see a pattern there with these kids, that their parents were also susceptible, had some kind of vaccine?
Yes, I do, and I think I've discussed this with you in the past about people who have had vaccines repeated because they supposedly didn't take, quote-unquote, and then the parent suffers from, like, glandular fever, what we call mononucleosis, or Epstein-Barr, that type of symptom, after the repetition of particularly the MMR, and if there is a family history of cancer, I see these children to be more prone to have reaction to vaccine than any other. And it's just something I've noticed in my practice. I think other practitioners would concur that this seems to be kind of a hefty history. So those are the kinds of things I look for, whether there has been unexplained illness or unexplained fevers in the parents, or whether they had issues with vaccine.
That's so interesting. And well, you maybe see it in their family as well, not just the parents.
Right.
Yeah. I never even thought about that. My brother had a very bad unexplained fever, you know, that he was hospitalized for. It was that bad. So, interesting. So, given that, well, I was going to get into this a little bit later, but given that, you know, vaccines are often implicated, how do you feel about, and do you often use giving the vaccine in potency, or do you mostly go, you know, for just the constitutional remedy?
I look for the remedy.
Right.
If the remedy that's indicated is the vaccine in potency, or if there's been a definitive reaction, you know, if you can relate the child's condition or a big reaction to a vaccine, then sometimes I'll go there first if the symptoms match that of the vaccine. But, you know, what's interesting is the way I see it now, after a few years, is very different than the way I used to look at it. You know, I used to look for the symptoms of the vaccine remedy, and I don't so much do that anymore, because I think it, you can see some improvement, but you don't see cure.
From giving the vaccine?
Right.
Right. So just general constitutional treatment you've been most successful with?
Yes.
Yeah. So what kind of response can the parents expect? Now, I always lecture people about being patient and stuff, but I want you to tell them about that. What do you see first? What's the progress like? Let's say in this case for somebody who's successful or moderately successful at least.
Usually, there's after the remedy, there's one of two things happens: either nothing or appears to be nothing, or there's a period of agitation. And the agitation can take the form of sleeplessness, hyperactivity, hand slapping, running around. Just sort of, it depends on the inclination of the child to begin with. But oftentimes there's some period within the first month where the parents kind of just say, oh, this can't be working, he's off the wall. And to me, that's a good sign that there's at least some movement.
How long will that last usually?
It's different with each child. For some kids it's only a couple of days, and for other kids it can be weeks.
Right. But you see that as a positive sign.
Well, as we know with homeopathy, it can be one or the other, and time is always the factor that is most critical in trying to decide whether something's working or not. But I don't let it go on. I mean, I certainly wouldn't let a child, you know, go on night after night of being sleepless without at least tweaking the remedy in some way.
Right. So, I mean...
Yeah, but within a month, I usually do the first follow-up 3 to 4 weeks. And the parents usually, if the remedy is working, there will be something they'll say, oh my gosh, just yesterday he started using more words, or just yesterday he said his brother's name and he never knew his brother existed before. Something to that effect, where there's some kind of cognitive little development that is enough to make us all wait.
Right.
Whether we're dosing on a daily basis or a weekly basis, or however we do it. So that's what I look for, is just a little glimmer of cognition. If I don't see it and there's still a period of aggravation, then I consider changing the remedy.
So a month is basically the time frame.
Yes.
Right. So you expect to see at least something in a month. That's actually what I've been telling people.
Yeah.
Now after that point, though, let's say we're saying this is in, you've gotten the right remedy. What time frame? Everybody asks me how long is this going to take. So. Maybe you can talk about that.
Only God knows, really. It's so different with every child. I usually, if someone comes to me, let's say 4 years old, and since 18 months old they lost their speech and their ability to relate or whatever, I will tell the parents I'm looking at 2 years of trying to find the right remedy and trying to have the remedy do its job. If something happens sooner than that, that's great. And if not, at least we'll, you know, know, if you stick with it long enough, the chances of finding a good remedy are really quite good, I think, and getting better all the time.
Right. How, you know, many people ask me, what about older autistic children? I know that it's better the younger you can get them, but have you had any success with older kids?
I have, actually. In a couple of cases, it was remarkable. And one of them was a child who was never immunized, which is kind of interesting. But he was one of these kids that had kind of a difficult family history. One of his parents was adopted, and there was this whole gap. But it was his mother, I believe, that was adopted. And he did really well. It took me a while. It was like the third or fourth remedy before I got any response whatsoever.
How old was he?
He was 13.
Oh, so that is even past puberty.
Yeah.
So that's another breaking point, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's honestly, I think the trick is convincing parents that it's in their best interest to hang with this for a while. Just because the condition is new, and so the remedies that we need to use, some of them we sort of have to invent as we go along. We're trying to treat something that hasn't existed in this population previous to this time. So it takes a little bit of grace and creativity sometimes to kind of come up with the right thing. And there are a lot of homeopaths. Luke Klein, you know, is, I think, in my book, doing some amazing work with this, thinking outside the box and trying to figure out what it is about these children that we need to look for in nature, match this pathology. And I think, you know, they're kind of opening the door on some new ways of looking at this.
Right. Lou Klein is one of my teachers, too. I don't know if you know, I also did his course.
Yeah.
So what do you find are the ingredients of success? I know that John Melnichuk, we interviewed him on a previous show, finds that sort of the family dynamic is really a good predictor of success. Have you found that? And
absolutely.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I think for a family, I will say, probably with no exception, but maybe one, where at least one of the parents is totally committed to homeopathy for at least, you know, a year or an extended period of time, and they're willing to stay connected. And that's really important because it's the nuances of a remedy and the kid's response to the remedy that really help you discern which direction things are going in. So parents, and sometimes the other things parents are doing actually interfere with the action of the remedy or mask the symptoms of the remedy. But I think good communication, realization that we're working this together. You know, I might be the person that decides where we go in terms of homeopathy, but they're the person that's with this child day in and day out. And just trying to communicate, if we can both communicate, I'll tell them, this is what I look for in a child. And just because a child's having a temper tantrum doesn't mean that we're going in the wrong direction here. This actually might be terrible tooth coming for the first time in a five-year-old.
Right, they're trying to express themselves.
Yes. And so, and then the parents educate me about their child and the uniqueness of that child. And it's that uniqueness that helps me hone the remedy choice. So, you know, like this one little boy in particular, I can remember his mother saying, this was after I'd given him two or three remedies and nothing was happening, except he was becoming more agitated in the evenings and he would circle around the house and circle around the kitchen and snatch food off people's plates, you know?
Yeah.
And I ended up giving him seagull, the remedy made from seagull feather, and it made a huge difference in him. But it was this little behavior that kind of emerged after a series of remedies that was most helpful.
I've heard a lot of people, also Pierre Fontaine and Judith Reichenberg, all been talking about animal remedies for these kids. And it's interesting because, you know, Temple Grandin's book about, you know, her work with animals and how autistic kids see the world the way animals do.
Yeah.
So this is, it's an emerging theme I'm hearing a lot.
Yeah.
Even though I must say my son, like Max, never had an animal remedy, but I've been hearing that a lot from other homeopaths. So now back to the parents. I mean, I know in this population the anxiety, the stress, the sort of grasping and running around, you know, just it's so huge. So you get these parents come in and they're completely trying everything, doing everything. What do you say to them? What do you recommend? What have you found? What treatments can they continue? Which interfere? What do you have to say about that whole issue?
Well, in terms of speech therapy and you know, working in an educational setting, I don't think that sometimes it's a stress to the child, but I think it's, you know, if it makes the parents feel better and they can maintain some normalcy that way, that's great. Supplements, depending on the supplements, I don't see it as such a problem unless we're just single dosing the child, and then we have to watch out for strong herbs, Chinese herbs, and that sort of thing.
So Chinese herbs you found to interfere?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about, like, people, you know, are very worried about the gut problems, like, and they take enzymes and stuff like that? What about
that? I don't see that as a problem. You know, it's more, that's just assisting already normal processes in the gut. So it's not like they're interfering in any way. And the bifida probiotics, that sort of thing, I just don't see that as a problem. And I think it actually can help in a lot of cases.
And the diets, the gluten-free, casein-free, all that?
Well, it depends on the child. I have cases where parents don't know anything at all about nutrition, and they feed their kids whatever they choose to, including cookies, and it doesn't seem to interfere. If they're going to get well, they get well in spite of all that. So I think it just depends on the child's constitution. Some kids can take a lot, and others are so fragile that they really need to be careful about what they eat. But I don't tell... No, usually parents are plugged in another way rather than just homeopathy. And I learn a lot from them, actually, in terms of that. But I don't think it's a bad idea, and in some cases it's imperative that they be gluten-free, casein-free.
Now, so a lot of parents are just obsessed, and I actually talk about this a lot to them, with, you know, the metals in the body. You know,
yeah,
my kids got the metals. And I always say, what's important is how they're behaving, not the numbers on the medals, you know. But they are obsessed with getting the medals out. And so the whole chelation issue, or people talk about, you know, there's a lot of practitioners out there who aren't doing classical homeopathy, the homeopathic detox,
right,
all that. What do you have to say about all that?
Well, having not used homeopathic detox, I can't speak to that, but I can tell you that I've had patients who have seen other practitioners who have been treated that way and had some improvement but haven't gone on to greater success, but have done it with a different remedy. And I think in some cases, that in most cases, if you get the right remedy, the body will naturally chelate most of the heavy metals. I think in some cases, depending on the condition of the liver and so forth, it may be necessary to do something else. But in most cases, I've seen it end up not being a problem. The body wants to be well. You know, we're designed to optimize whatever we give the body, and so it knows how to take care of itself. It just sometimes needs a little nudge.
Right.
That's what we ask the remedy to do. I do think a lot of these kids can benefit from craniosacral massage, and I do recommend, if I get a sense that it would be important for the child that the parents go ahead and do that. Kids that stand on their head a lot, you know, hanging upside down a lot, banging their heads, hitting themselves in the head. I oftentimes recommend that I'll get some craniosacral.
I know that John also recommends that, and in fact we use that too, and I thought it was also critical in the case.
Uh-huh.
It helps speed things up. So any other tips or any other things that you found that help the progress with these kids or hinder it? Things that get in the way?
Well, I think anxiety is a huge factor in terms of parents, and particularly if a child has had this condition for a while, if they start when they're little and then they're getting to be school age, and I think it's heartbreaking for most parents, and it's almost like by the time the child's 4 years old, if they haven't seen any change, they're just really frustrated and anxious about, will my child ever be well? And I just think it's important to realize that kids will catch up, that the way we have been trained to think about development is kind of unnatural, in a sense that because a child at the age of 5 isn't doing the same things that are on the chart for the median of kids that age, they catch up so dramatically fast once they start to get well, that my mantra with parents is just relax. And, you know, just relax. He wants to be well. And it's a huge tension in the family when you have a child that isn't developing in what we think of as a normal way. And I just think it's important to just relax and enjoy the child and get help. Get some help in terms of respite care or grandparents who can step in and help for a weekend so that the whole family can heal.
How often do you actually treat the parents as well? I mean, do you find that really helps the case?
Yes. I would love to treat all the parents of all these kids. You know, in some cases it's not feasible or practical, whether it's for financial reasons, and I don't ever let that stand in the way. I think it's important to make this available to people who need it, but I really think it's a wonderful adjunct, and having experienced the effects of a remedy, a parent can understand how subtle the changes are oftentimes, and that it allows them to be more patient.
Right. Now, everybody out there, listen to that. It's very important. Be patient. It's so amazing. People will try and then give up after a month, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not that kind of thing. It's much more deep than that, so it's going to take some time.
I think also that children are coming into the world a lot more sensitive than they ever have been. And that's a wonderful thing. We're living in a different world than we were when my children were born, even. And the factors that affect them deeply. But I think their resilience is greater than the children that came before them. I think their ability to bounce back is quite good.
Have you noticed that the younger kids now are actually more resilient?
I think they're resilient in a different way. When you stop and look at the way kids play nowadays, everything's faster. Everything's quicker. The sports that children are engaging in, they're like skateboarding and trampolining, and children are more nimble in many, many ways. But they're barraged by these forces that weren't around 40 years ago. Microwaves and ultrasound and all these things. Who knows, maybe these things are an enhancement to the human race, you know. But I just know that kids are different and they're quicker in a lot of ways, and I'm trusting that it means they're more resilient on a deeper level.
That's It's really interesting. Has it affected the kind of remedies you give these kids too?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Do you think that you know, everybody says what causes autism, and usually I, you know, say in my view it's not at least 90% vaccinations and
yeah.
But you know, and not just the thimerosal, but the vaccines themselves as well. I mean, do you have a view about that?
I do, and I don't. I used to think, oh, you know, it's just the vaccine, and it's, you know, the mercury, and the fact that we're ingesting foreign protein into children. But you know, I think it's more the idea that we've forgotten that we are intact. We come into this world working the way we're supposed to work, and from the moment we're born and before, we're exposed to these things that aren't biologically in our best interest. So who's to say what's causing this? What's causing this susceptibility? I don't know. Is it family history? Is it vaccination? I certainly think until we understand it, we have to err on the side of caution. But I do feel, I mean, when you see a parent bring a child in and say, you know, he had his CPT MMR, and the next day he was a vegetable, it's kind of obvious that that's what that child's susceptibility was.
Right. Right. Well, from your mouth to God's ears, you know, to help us, really. It's just a crime what's going on. So, but thank God, you know, homeopathy has been helpful, and hopefully more people will find out about it too, that will need a lot more homeopaths like you. So
I think the more people that turn to homeopathy, the more success we're going to have. Ask any homeopath and they'll tell you they learn from their patients, they learn from their cases more than we can learn in any other way, and we just need the opportunity to try, and you know, and we can get there. I think we'll do it, and I think, in, you know, in terms of public health in general, homeopathy has way more to offer than traditional medicine, and we may get the opportunity to see that in the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, and one of these days we're going to actually meet in person. I know that.
We keep threatening.
Yeah. So thanks again for all your good work. And if people want to contact you, do you want to give any contact numbers or emails or whatever?
Sure. My email address is Nancy R F as in Sam HOM at yahoo.com. And my phone number is 860-501-1487. I'm on the web in various places, autism websites and homeopathic websites. I'm happy to talk to parents and help the homeopathic speech here.
So your main practice is in Portland, Maine?
Yes.
And you also have this office in Connecticut?
Yep. And in Kittery, Maine. I have an office there also.
Kittery?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm writing that down myself. I thought you closed the Connecticut office.
I closed the office, but not the practice.
Oh, okay.
I continue to go down once a month to follow up with.
So is this in Mystic or somewhere else?
It's actually in New London.
Oh, okay. But you're not seeing new patients there?
I do once in a while.
Okay.
Like I said before, we learn from our patients, and I can't not take new cases because that's how I learn new remedies.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Nance.
My pleasure.
And,
Care, Amy.
Yeah, you too.
Alrighty.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, well, that was really interesting. I hope you all enjoyed that. And I just want to repeat the contact information for Nancy. It's Nancy R.S. Hom, so it's NancyRshom at yahoo.com. And her phone number, 860-501-1487. Okay, well, I'm just going to do a little conclusion here. First of all, my next show is in November the 3rd Friday in November. I don't have it right here, but whatever that is. And during that show, I'm going to begin a discussion about the history of homeopathy in the United States, which will include a discussion about the success of the treatment of various serious epidemics, including flu epidemics. So maybe I'll also bone up a little and talk about the flu next time. Also, if you have any questions for me, you can always send me an email. I do a lot of correspondence with parents. You can send me an email at alansky@autism1.org. So that's A-L-A-N-S-K-Y at autism1.org. Or just send me an email at lansky@impossiblecure.com. And once again, encouraging you all to visit the Impossible Cure website, impossiblecure.com. Another great resource is a new Yahoo group that was founded this year after I gave a talk about homeopathy for autism, and the organizer of that talk set up this website and Yahoo group within a week, and it's grown. I think we have 200 or 300 people on it now. It's Homeopathy for Special Needs Children. So the website is homeopathysnc.org. And if you go to that site, it'll tell you how to sign up for the Yahoo group. Finally, for more general information about homeopathy, everyone should visit the site of the National Center for Homeopathy, homeopathic.org, H-O-M-E-O-P-A-T-H-I-C.org. It's a great organization, and I encourage you all to join it because you get all kinds of benefits. Plus, I'm on the board of the organization. The National Center really is the force out there trying to protect homeopathy and educate people. There's tons of resources and information on the website, and if you join the National Center, you'll be supporting homeopathy, but you'll also receive a fantastic magazine, Homeopathy Today, that's full of information about homeopathy, lots of tips about self-treatment for common ailments. You'll also get their e-newsletter and more access to more online resources, including online Materia Medica, online chats, and in the future, we're developing extensions this coming year to the website, including we hope to have online B-board facilities for various ailments, so I'll be sure to have a B-board about autism. Anyway, that's about it for today, and remember, there really is hope with homeopathy.